Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from the CFRC Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering the opening of the new recreation hub on Princess Street.
Kingston is carving out a new place on Canada's clean tech map. The Reaction Hub officially opened its doors last week at 945 Princess Street. It's a first-of-its-kind center for green chemistry innovation. Developed in partnership with the City of Kingston and Modern Niagara, with a $3 million investment from the city to drive sustainable technology and economic growth. The hub brings together lab, pilot, and manufacturing spaces under one roof to help chemistry-based innovations make the leap from research to real-world production. I spoke with Morgan Letnin, Executive Director of the Reaction Hub, about what this means for Kingston and how the city's long chemistry legacy is continuing to evolve and lead the charge. Well, to start us off, I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for our listeners.
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Morgan Letnin, and I am the Executive Director of Reaction Hub, but prior to that was a BSc 2016 and PhD 2022 graduate from Queen's in the chemistry department, and absolutely loved my over a decade at the university, and I'm excited now to be running an organization here in Kingston that supports the scale-up and commercialization of sustainable chemistry-based technologies.
Awesome. And for those hearing about it for the first time, what is the Reaction Hub? What's happening here in Kingston?
Yeah, so Reaction Hub is, as I said, an enabler of the commercialization of chemistry technologies. So this organization came to be a couple years ago when the ecosystem of chemistry within the Kingston region came together. We have, you know, great researchers at Queen's, but also service providers or these kind of technical experts with Kingston Process Metallurgy and a few others. It all came together and said, we have this really long chemistry history in Kingston with DuPont setting up its global scale-up facility here in the 40s. And there's some, what else can we do to amplify that ability and really fill a gap within the commercialization of chemistry technologies? Because the challenges that we have to solve, from climate change to ensuring, you know, economic resilience, are all can be solved with new sustainable chemistry technologies. So myself and a business partner both were former chemistry entrepreneurs, and we joined forces with this group in the city of Kingston and some other partners to try and solve that challenge. So Reaction Hub, as I said, has a couple different ways that we support these scaling chemistry technologies and companies. One with a facility at sort of the center of town. It's in a building that's a little bit over 200,000 square feet. We have purpose-built lab piloting and scale-up facilities. You can bring a technology all the way from, you know, that past lab scale where it's been validated at a university, you now need to know what's next, all the way up to commercial scale. And then we do that in partnership and in with support from strategic services. So how do you, the who, what, where, and how much does it cost to get a technology to market? And then really helping these technologies understand how do they make the biggest impact.
Mm-hmm. And you dove right into this, but I was wondering if we could rewind a bit. Could you kind of describe what the valley of death is when we're talking about that jump from research to commercialization?
Yes, this is a the scary valley of death. So this really detrimental phase in the development of a chemical technology where getting outside of, you know, when you validate it, as we said, at the lab, and you go, okay, we've got something great here. We've invented something. It's got potential. There's a couple reasons why these types of technologies often die and they never actually make it to market. One, it's extremely expensive. So the equipment and the instruments and the facilities that you need change at every scale. And to get from that lab to, you know, something that's at hundreds of milliliters to hundreds of thousands of liters to millions of liters, the equipment that you need along the way is drastically different. So there's a cost component. There's also a time when you're inventing a new technology. That can take, you know, multiple PhD, you know, to take a professor's entire career potentially. And then there's also the next phase of getting it to market, which could take another 5 to 10 years. So the time is a challenge. And then the expertise. So at every stage, from the scientist to the engineer, but also the legal advice, the IP advice, the business knowledge, the finance knowledge, the how do you get investors? So all of these different pieces have to come together, and they're different at every phase. So this is where there's this valley of death that happens, where these technologies, no matter how much potential they have, sometimes just don't make it over the edge.
And how's the Reaction Hub kind of stepping in here and bridging that gap?
Yeah, so that was truly, we said, how do we fill this, and how do we try and make the process of getting that technology through commercialization either more time effective, more cost effective, and, you know, try and take away some headaches along the way, because it's not easy. So one, with our infrastructure and the facilities that I mentioned, the way that we've designed the space is that it's in a flexible model. So think about it like co-working for science or co-working for chemical processes, where the equivalent at this time, normally a company has to go find a warehouse and spend hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars to make the electrical and the water and the gas and everything that you need to do a chemical process. They have to do that themselves. Or build a whole brand new building that can cost millions and millions of dollars. So instead, you can come to us and access the space for a flexible amount of time. And then that allows you, when you complete, you know, your goal, you get to the next stage, we can now rejig and build you a new amount of space. So instead of spending hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars to build something that will then in 2 years need to change, you can be flexible with that. So on the infrastructure, that's that piece. We also have one of the big exciting things that was announced and really put out into the ecosystem this past week was the city of Kingston invested $3 million for capital expenses. So to have the equipment and the instruments in the building that these companies can need will need. And we offer it on a pay-per-use test, so a more accessible way for companies to access the equipment that they normally would not be able to buy themselves. So infrastructure, equipment, and then on the expertise and talent, we represent an ecosystem. We have over 100, we call them project delivery partners, so partners and organizations that we trust that we help pull the pieces together so that you get the right help at the right time.
And I'm not really in this world, so I'm kind of curious, is this like a first of its kind of project? Did you take inspiration from other things that were happening?
Yeah, so the really unique thing is the building and the facility that we're in, that we, with our main partner, Modern Niagara, who's the owner of the building, which is Canada's largest HVAC and mechanical contracting company. This building has a ton of Kingston history. It was been around since the 1940s, always with a chemistry, innovation, and manufacturing kind of lens to it. But the different spaces that we have, so the labs, piloting and scale-up facilities, all the way to areas that are zoned a factory where you can actually sell a product, having all of those in one spot in close proximity offered in this types of flexible way makes it the first of its kind in the world at the moment, which is really exciting. You know, there are other facilities coming online in the next, you know, few years, which we are super happy about, because we focus on chemistry, but getting a facility that does something similar in biology would also be amazing. So being able to work collaboratively across the country to really improve not only Kingston, but Ontario and Canada's strength in you know, climate change and economic resilience.
Mm-hmm. And you definitely spoke to this at the beginning, but why Kingston specifically?
Yes. So really the why Kingston is this ecosystem that's present here. Having organizations that have been building over 25 years. So if we go even back further, we said DuPont started up here in the 1940s. There were other organizations that sort of came in through the generations. And then Kingston Process Metallurgy, Green Center Canada, a really strong chemistry and chemical engineering capabilities at Queen's, but also having a municipality in our city that truly wanted to invest into something innovative. Kingston was the first city to declare climate emergency a handful of years ago, and they're really taking action to actually try and solve these challenges. There's also other benefits of, which a lot of people don't know this statistic either, but Kingston has the highest per capita chemical process specialists in Canada. We are at a huge capita, but there's a ton of concentration where we can be pulling on and working with, 200 to 300 different specialists at a time, able to help with these projects. So really, Kingston has an ecosystem, it has the expertise, and it's been building what we kind of say that's a really fertile soil that's been developed and tilled over years and years and years and years, and sets up a really strong foundation to be able to help companies like this. And, we want to and are putting Kingston as sort of the center of the chemistry or chemtech, as we call it, ecosystem in Canada and really the world.
Wow. Thank you for all that background. I didn't know a lot of that.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys opened up this week. How has that energy been?
Yeah, so we've been, it's been quite a long time coming. We've been working, our team really started pushing through this in 2022 and went through, fundraising and construction and all these kind of things, and then had the facility open its doors at the end of 2024. And then now we've had our first client move in as of last month, which is what pushed us. Okay, it's time to have the official ribbon cutting and say, okay, here we are. Let's move forward. So the energy has been great. The local ecosystem is super exciting, and every person that we talk to is always willing to help in one way or another. But also, my business partner and I just came back from a 2-week trip to India, where a state government in India invited us to come to speak about the Reaction Hub model, with the wanting to collaborate specifically because this is something so novel unique in the ecosystem, that they said, okay, well, how do we do something like that? We want to work together and learn. So not only locally, but globally, Kingston is getting attention for doing something really unique. And I feel so lucky to get to work on that every day.
Awesome. And what kind of partners are already, involved in the hub?
Yeah. So we have an ecosystem of, as we said, kind of supporters. So when you think about the stakeholders that are required to bring a technology to market, there's working with academic institutions, but also with, business development. So this is your lawyers and your IP specialists and the technical experts, but also government and other kind of investors. But specifically, we split up our closest partners into something called alliances. So we either have technology development alliances, which is where we look at who are the experts that are really needed to make sure that the science and the engineering is right. So we work with KPM, with another organization called Lydium Engineering, of course have great relationships with Queen's and others, into the business development alliances, which is where we do all of our consulting services in alliance with Deloitte. So we're able to really access big amounts of data and expertise, and also a law firm called Dentons. And then into what we call technology adoption alliances. So we're able to develop technology, we're able to build the business around it, and then we help them actually get out into the world. And the one I wanted to really highlight is with Utilities Kingston, which also another story of what makes Kingston so awesome, is Utilities Kingston is the kind of organization umbrella that has everything from our city's wastewater, IoT, grid, and they have all these assets, and they're the ones that operate them. So they've built an alliance with us where we are to identify and kind of validate new technologies and then connect them with their team and build out projects to be able to actually test and deploy these technologies on Utilities Kingston's infrastructure. So imagining that, within a year, we could have a new water technology testing on a wastewater treatment plant, which is really fascinating. And we're it's a really cool offering that we're able to bring to our companies. And then really quickly, what I wanted to highlight is the first two companies that are operating in the building. So one, our first client, Undo Carbon, they're a X Prize winning carbon removal company using enhanced rock weathering. So they're from the UK, moved to Kingston to set up a Canadian operations because they were have a partnership with a wollastonite mine north of the city. They have been doing amazing work in the carbon removal space, have a contract with Microsoft for their carbon credits. They're just doing great, a wonderful team. So they're in our facility to do their processing and all of their kind of quality analysis testing. And then the second is a company called Carbon Lock Technologies that's based out of the Western Canada that we're doing a pilot project to take a bio oil that they're able to create to turn it into a bitumen, so fossil fuel replacement in asphalt. So how do we create a more sustainable road infrastructure? So everything is, how do we make these changes to just, you know, get the things that we need to live our daily lives a little bit greener?
Well, a strong start is an understatement, but what are you hoping for the future of the hub? What do you see in the next few years?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of really exciting opportunities. Not only the different companies that we are seeing becoming interested in, and the different technology types, like creating the new batteries and new recycling technologies for other materials. So the actual seeing the breadth of companies that can be supported. But I think what I'm the most excited about is being able to create a system that's a little bit friendlier and a little bit more efficient. So when I was a founder, it's really challenging. As we said, it can be lonely. There are so many, challenges or road bumps along the way. So now being able to create a system where you have infrastructure, you have the expertise when you need it, you have a ecosystem of organizations and former entrepreneurs that want to help. So really what I'm excited about for Reaction Hub is to have that place where people go, oh, I want to go there, one, because I get the best help, but also because I feel welcome and I feel supported. And being able to take that not just to support Canada, but to support the world, solve the many climate challenges that we have.
That was Morgan Lettinen, Executive Director of the Reaction Hub, Canada's newest center for green chemistry innovation right here in Kingston. With the city's investment and decades of chemical expertise behind it, the hub aims to turn Kingston into a national leader in sustainable tech and green industry. As Morgan mentioned, Kingston's innovation model is already gaining attention abroad, and the team hopes to make the Reaction Hub a blueprint for sustainable chemistry around the world. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Napanee Beaver, Sarah Williams, that provides an overview of the latest meeting of Greater Napanee's Town Council.
Thank you, Jesse. The Town of Greater Napanee Council was abuzz with discussion during their recent regular meeting on October 28th. Aside from an agenda full of noteworthy items, Council received deputations from Atura Power regarding Napanee BESS Phase 2 and representatives from the Napanee Raiders regarding revenue sharing. Council recently received a deputation from a company named Borelex looking for municipal support for their battery energy storage system project. Following that deputation, municipal support was granted for that particular BESS project. The latest request from Atura Power is one of several across the province in response to the independent electricity system operator issuing a request for proposals in order to secure new electricity resources. The Napanee BESS Phase 2 would build upon Phase 1. The existing BESS was granted approval by the IESO in 2023. As per Brad Kite, the addition would add 300 megawatts of capacity with a duration of 8 hours. Phase 2, as with Phase 1, will be within the Lennox Generating Station site. Assuming municipal support is granted by the town, successful bids will be announced by June 16, 2026. Construction of the Napanee BESS Phase 2 will take approximately 2 years, with the facility intended to be operational by 2030. Council also received a deputation from Max Kaiser, executive board member of the Napanee Raiders. Kaiser presented council with a revenue sharing opportunity from board advertisements at the Goodyear Rink in the Best and Bash Arena. Kaiser brought forward the idea of revenue sharing as a targeted strategy to offset the new cost of streaming games. With origins reaching back as far as the 1960s, the Raiders are Napanee's only junior hockey team. Their fan base spans generations, with Friday night games well attended by all ages. Recently, as per Kaiser, the Provincial Junior Hockey League mandated that all games need to be streamed live. Enabling this resulted in unforeseen costs for the team. The revenue sharing strategy proposed by Kaiser represents an investment in community without burdening the taxpayer. Unlike neighboring junior hockey team rinks, the ads at Goodyear Rink, as per Kaiser, are priced well below market value. With more revenue generated by these ads, Kaiser described a trickle-down effect that would benefit all users of the rink. Currently, the Raiders' revenue is limited to fees collected at the gates during games and from fundraising. After hearing the deputation from the Raiders, council directed staff to return with a report regarding the revenue-sharing request. Thank you to Sarah Williams for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for YGK News, Owen Fullerton, about the creation of a new animation studio in the city of Kingston.
Thank you, Dinah. As Kingston looks to continue to grow as a home for film and television production, the city will soon have a full-fledged animation and digital media studio that calls Kingston its permanent home. The new studio will be coming out of the gates with a fairly high-profile IP, with their first project already in development, an animated series alongside the renowned American author R.L. Stine, best known for the Goosebumps series of books. Donnie McIntyre, co-CEO and co-founder of Limestone Animations, said he thinks launching with such a recognizable piece of IP reinforces the studio's commitment to making itself and the city of Kingston a source of globally competitive animated content. He says that while they are excited for the project to launch, they can't get into details about it other than saying that it will be based off the author's newest anthology series, Stine Tinglers. McIntyre said having a recognizable name associated with the launch was a goal for he and his co-founder Sean Connolly, and they're excited to be able to have that be a creator that they themselves are fans of and serve a market that has somehow slipped through the cracks. The two founders, who have over 30 years of combined experience in the animation industry, were able to pitch to Stine and his team through a mutual connection and said they were on board for the animated series right away. McIntyre said the studio will eventually be moving into 3D animation and more experimental styles of projects, partnering with consultants with expertise ranging from streaming to video game development, but are focusing on 2D animation to start as they get their feet underneath them and grow their team. Stine Tinglers, he says, provides a great opportunity to do that with a big brand. The two co-founders also saw the potential for growth and support in Kingston from a municipal level, with the city's creative strategy making supporting creative industries like film a priority. Limestone Animation stated that the global animation market is currently valued at $400 billion US, but is projected to more than double to $896 billion by 2034. As such, it's a market that the city of Kingston can see value in being a part of. As such, they're providing a fair amount of support to Limestone Animations in the way of rent-free space, a property tax exemption, and up to $250,000 to help cover startup costs and capital expenses previously approved by City Council. McIntyre credited the city for the huge amount of support they've given to make this a reality, and he says he thinks the community can also benefit from their presence and become a powerhouse in digital media and animation, with local programs and courses at schools like Queen's University and Loyalist already providing a bit of a pipeline. McIntyre noted that Canada's three largest cities are the most known for animation, as for many other industries, but smaller cities throughout Canada are starting to carve out a place, and Kingston could be one of them.
And thank you to Kate Dempsey for that story. Now over to the LJAI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about a name change for the W.J. Henderson Community Centre.
Loyalist Township has announced the new name for the Aquatic Centre at the W.J. Henderson Community Centre. Through a gift agreement for naming rights with Bar Homes and a $250,000 donation from the company, the space will be named the Bar Homes Aquatic Centre. Council approved the 10-year agreement at their latest meeting. CAO Rebecca Murphy spoke about the agreement with Bar Homes.
Bar Homes has agreed to sign on, be a major donor in the Tier 3 category, to name the Aquatic Center at the facility at the WJ. This is very great. We're very gracious and very thankful to Bar for stepping up and being part of this vital community project, and we're excited to be naming it and recommending that it be named the Barr Homes Aquatic Center.
The renewal of the entire center has been a large ongoing project for the township. The revitalization campaign was approved by council on December 10th, 2024, with a goal of raising $2 million. The new space will feature an 8-lane, 25-meter pool, a new warm water leisure pool, updates to arena infrastructure, enhanced accessibility, updated change rooms, green energy upgrades, and a new Indigenous legacy space in partnership with the Downey-Wenjack Fund. Residents can expect to see the new name used in township marketing materials. It will be displayed inside on the west wall of the space, as well as a location on the exterior of the building, to be agreed on at a later date. Barr Homes will also be recognized on the donor wall to be located in the atrium of the building. Barr Homes has over 70 years of history in the construction industry within Kingston and the surrounding areas. According to the company, they build approximately 60 homes annually in Kingston and Loyalist Township. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with an update on the creation of a warming center in Northumberland County.
Northumberland County headquarters in Cobourg will be the home of a warming hub this winter. With the nightly temperatures falling and time being an issue, county mayors met virtually Tuesday to discuss a county staff report which recommended four locations, that being the county headquarters, the paramedic facility, and two rural options. County Warden and Brighton Mayor Brian Ostrander described the situation as a go or no-go option, previously stating that there was a 50% chance this warming room would not proceed. Discussion focused on the finer details of that proposal, with Cobourg Mayor Lucas Cleveland suggesting the warming room not be open 24 hours a day, wanting the county to follow a similar model to that of Durham's warming center, of just providing a warming space with no wraparound services, and to follow tight rules and regulations, including no drug use and violence.
This warming hub should be run by the county, by county staff, and that this warming hub should not operate 24 hours a day, but should be operated from 8 p.m. till 8 a.m. and starting November 15th to March 31st. I agree, we need a warming room. We need a place to for people to stay warm and not die, as some of our individuals said.
County staff have identified using the council chambers to serve as the warming room, with users having access to washroom facilities. Cleveland expressed that county staff operate the facility, while county acting CAO Glenn Dees said a third party for staffing and security may be used with oversight from the county. Cobourg Council would need to pass an exemption to their emergency care establishment bylaw to issue a third permit to the county. Colborne Mayor Mandy Martin had reservations that Cobourg would dictate to the county how to run the warming room. However, Cobourg Council has final approval over whether the county is granted a bylaw exemption. Cleveland will present a motion before his council to consider the existing Golden Plow long-term care facility as the future site of the warming room. Senior residents there are soon set to move to a new long-term care facility, yet Dee said there are challenges with the province in using both facilities. The examination of the Golden Plow will be looked at later, possibly for the winter of 2026. County staff will prepare a report quickly on the logistics of opening the warming room for as soon as possible. It will cost approximately $218,000 to operate the seven-day-a-week facility. Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, November 6th, 7 degrees, partly sunny, 25% chance of rain, overnight low of 1 degree, so right around the freezing point. Friday, November 7th, 8 degrees with a 60% chance of precipitation in the afternoon, dropping down just a single degree to 7 overnight. Saturday, November 8th, 9 degrees with intervals of cloud and sunshine throughout the day, dropping down to 5 overnight. Sunday, November 9th, daytime high of 9, 75% chance of rain in the morning, otherwise just kind of cloudy and gray. And moving into the start of next week, Monday, November 10th, daytime high of just 5, dropping down to 0 overnight.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
Hello, this is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. Does local news matter to you? CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC raise $25,000 this year and make your gift today via CFRC.ca. Don't forget to tune in for daily news programming and subscribe to our news podcast to keep up with the latest in your community.
Calling all AMS members, CFRC 101.9 FM is aiming to renew its optional student fee at referendum this fall. Help your campus radio station serve our community with news, music, arts programming, podcasts, and more. Watch your emails for ballots from the AMS and vote yes for CFRC's fee increase on November 12th, 13th, and 14th. Your voice, your station, your vote. Thank you for your support.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. This is Adam. I'm here with Kyle today. This is episode 9. This one's a little bit of a somber episode to start it off because we do have to acknowledge the Toronto Blue Jays losing the World Series to the Los Angeles Dodgers in an insane Game 7. One of the craziest baseball games I've ever seen personally. They had a few chances to close it out and win it, and they just weren't able to get it done. Kyle, there's been a lot of controversy about like people saying that the Jays should have won all these different ways, and whether it was the home run to tie it that the Dodgers hit with two outs left, or it was the Isaiah Kiner-Falefa not taking off as quickly as he should have, allegedly, from third base in extra innings. There's a lot of blame pointed around right now, but I think that the bigger thing we got to realize is that this was a great success for the Jays.
I mean, yeah, I think my takeaway from it is more just like, I mean, the way baseball itself is set up, it's not really inherently a fair game. Like, you have teams that just have way more resources than the others. Like, I mean, if you did that in any other sport, it would be a washout each year. So I don't know. I mean, the fact that the Dodgers almost lost, I would say that I would compare it to like the idea that they almost lost. That's kind of embarrassing. Like, they have so many resources behind them, and yet they like struggled to win the World Series. I mean, that's my takeaway from it. You can blame some of the issues the Blue Jays had. Like, sure. I think they played exceptionally well. I mean, they got like so much value out of players that they don't pay much for, or people they called up. Like, I mean, it's kind of hard to complain with that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, like, aside from Vladdy, they had like a team of glue guys. Like, they had a team of like all guys that are just doing whatever it takes to make the wins happen. I mean, you could see the emotion from like Ernie Clement. I feel like he's like the best example of it. I mean, he's not on the biggest contract on the team, but he talked about how much he enjoys being around the team and how these are like his best friends and he loves coming to work every day. And I think that's rare in a lot of professional sports, but especially baseball, because I feel like there's so many players on the team. Like, players are going from up and down AAA to AA to the majors. There's a lot of rotation, a lot of people getting traded or cut throughout the season, and it's hard to have a lot of cohesion within those players. But the Jays were able to do that, and I think it showed. I mean, they were never down and out. Even when they were down 5-4 at the end of the World Series, like going into the bottom of the 11th, I think, I still had confidence that they were going to be able to pull something out or get something going, and they almost did. So I know what you mean. I think that this is like the Dodgers just didn't seem to have that kind of like team work going. They seem to get carried by Yamamoto a lot. I mean, I think the series would have looked completely different if Yamamoto was not in this series. But I mean, wow. I mean, he was rightfully so the MVP of the series, just with the way he played. How impressed with Yamamoto were you?
Yeah, I mean, the guy was ridiculous. It just seemed like no one could do anything against him, and he did literally had almost no mistakes. I mean, I don't really understand how that was possible. Yeah. But yeah, like, yeah, that was pretty ridiculous. I mean, I think my other thing I would say is that the Blue Jays have everything the Toronto Maple Leafs don't, in the sense of they have an even bigger fan base than the Maple Leafs that's just as passionate when it comes to playoffs, but they don't ream out and crush the players during the regular season, because maybe it's kind of more of like I'll admit it, I don't watch the Blue Jays like that frequently. Once in a while I'll turn on like a game and watch a part of it, mm-hmm. but I'm not like a regular viewer of them.
Yeah.
But so like in that sense, the like culture as a Blue Jays player is, I mean, I don't know that much about the other teams, but as far as I could tell, probably the best between all the other options in the MLB.
Yeah, it seems like one of the best ones that I've ever seen. I followed baseball for a while now and even looked at like World Series teams, and none of them seem to have like, I mean, that like team chemistry going on. I mean, I think it reminds me, I mean, I think it's also because I'm watching a lot of Montreal Canadiens hockey right now, but it reminds me of the Montreal Canadiens. I don't know if you've been able to see a few of their games and just the way they kind of support each other and react when it comes to either game overtime winning goals or even in losses. Like, they always seem to be like backing each other up, saying that they're coming back and getting another one. And I do think that that contributes to success. I think that even if you're a team that was like struggling last few years, like Montreal, building a culture like that is huge and can clearly have great impacts. I mean, especially on a baseball team. But yeah, no, the Dodgers with their finances, I mean, it really did feel a little unfair. The MLB is getting close to their next collective bargaining agreement. And people think that there's going to be some resistance from teams because of the Dodgers and because of the way that they've deferred the salary on all of these major contracts, by kind of saying it's unfair. So a potential MLB lockout might be in the future here. Do you think that, I mean, technically this is available for any team to do, and I mean, it has been done before, not to this scale like the Dodgers have done it. But do you think it's inherently unfair with how they structured the contracts of certain players like Ohtani, with like essentially for the listeners, he gets paid $2 million per year until 2033. And then from 2033 to like 2049, he gets about $68 million a year. And his contract's actually up with the Dodgers when he's getting paid those $68 million a year, which allows them to have a lot more space to sign players. And it's not like they even really need the space, because there is no salary cap in the MLB. It's all just up to the owners and how much money they want to put into the team. But Kyle, do you think it's unfair? Do you think we might see a lockout coming up?
I mean, I could see that being a possibility. Like, there's definitely, like, honestly, the Blue Jays aren't even, I feel like they're not even the ones receiving like the shortest end of the stick there, because they're not like that small of a market, but relative, I guess they're still smaller than LA Dodgers. But at the same time, I mean, there's definitely a couple teams that are like do you see them even being like able to ever win with the current rules?
I mean, I kind of know what you mean. Like, there's some teams that, I mean, I feel like have been in the gutter for so long. I think of the Pittsburgh Pirates. They were good for a couple years back in the 2010s, but they've been kind of a bottom feeder for a while now. And that's just simply because they don't have the money from ownership like teams like Toronto and the Dodgers do. And they have the best pitcher, arguably, in baseball in Paul Skeens. So, I mean, it's crazy how, like, sometimes these best players in the league will never even touch playoff baseball. I mean, Shohei Ohtani is the perfect example of being the best player in the MLB for his first 2 years with the Los Angeles Angels and not making the playoffs either times. And he had Mike Trout on that team. Like, he had one of the best American baseball players of all time on the Angels, and they didn't even sniff the playoffs. And then he goes to the Dodgers and has won a World Series in every year that he's played for the Dodgers. It does seem unfair to me, and I do think that there needs to be some kind of restrictions put on. I think it's similar to when, like, the NHL decided to, like, make the contracts, like, 8 years is the max that you could do that, and they kind of restricted how much money you can defer. I think they kind of need that. I don't think baseball necessarily needs a salary cap. I think that that's kind of unique to the game, and yeah, if you're mad at your team's ownership, you should protest. I mean, you see, like, with the Athletics, I mean, how, like, they had, like, so many protests when there were threats to move the team. Obviously, the protest did not work, as the team did end up getting moved. But you do see a lot of protests for, like, teams requesting the owners to sell the team, and you get a lot of that in baseball, and I think that is unique. Even if it might be painful as a fan, I still think that it is kind of part of the game. But your thoughts on that?
As an Ottawa Senators fan, I know the feeling. We had management, Peter Previous, that used to spend under the salary cap. I can't remember the figure. I think it was about $15 million under. So our team was terrible because of it, and it was brutal. Yeah, not only was it bad because we couldn't spend money to get new players, we couldn't afford to hold on to prospects. So, like, we lost a ton of prospects in those years because we couldn't afford to hold on to them. So, I mean, yeah, it totally disrupts everything if you're spending that much less than the next team, basically. So I understand the issues, and people definitely weren't happy with our management.
No, and that's totally fair. I think we'll jump over to hockey now, just now that we brought it up a little bit. But the Senators and the Habs played a couple days ago. I don't know if you got a chance to watch a little bit of the game. I know I was sending some GIFs into the chat when Montreal was scoring. But Montreal was able to win 4-3 in overtime. But Ottawa, both teams looked good in the game. I mean, Montreal got out to an early 2-0 lead, but Ottawa fought back. Looks solid. Even without Brady Tkachuk, Ottawa is still kind of doing okay. I mean, their record 6-5-2, but every team in the East right now is above 500, which is, I mean, I feel kind of unheard of, especially, and maybe it's only 12 games into the season, but still, I mean, it's kind of hard to believe that every team in the East is doing above mid, I guess. But your thoughts on the Sens season so far and some of the Montreal game?
I'll give you a weird statistic. So the worst goaltending in the entire league right now is Linus Allmark.
Okay.
You know, I want to blame the guy, but it seems like the same weird curse happens to whatever goalie that Ottawa picks up. So I don't really understand it. I mean, obviously our defense has some serious, inefficiencies or something going on there, but it's kind of hard to, like, understand because, like, with those kind of numbers, like, it is him. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, I don't get how it could be happening to every goalie that comes to Ottawa. Like, there's something we're doing to the players. It's whether it's, like, mentally or the goalie coach. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's not going well. If we had good goaltending, like, or if our goaltending numbers were good, I should say, like, Ottawa would be, like, one of the best teams in the league right now. But yeah, the goalie numbers just with that kind of it's amazing that we're above, like, we're at where we are right now with the worst goaltending in the entire league. Like, that's kind of impressive, but
yeah,
maybe not in the best way.
No, but I also think it's something that can be sorted out. I mean, it's so early in the season, right? I don't think that this is, like, going to be the factor that the that forces the Sens to be a like a team that doesn't make the playoffs. I think that they are a solid team still, and I mean, even when Tkachuk comes back, this team is going to be even more dangerous, right? So I think with Allmark, I mean, I don't know what their backup situation like. Is it Marilainen, the backup?
Yeah, Marilainen.
Okay. So, like, I don't know how many starts does Marilainen get. Is he getting some playing time?
A couple.
Yeah.
He's had a couple, and he's also up in the top 10 for bad goaltending, too, or something like that. So. Yeah.
So I mean, like, it might be more defensive issues then, too. I mean, so I think finding the root of the cause is definitely something that Ottawa will definitely be doing, but... I mean, it's not like they're playing poor hockey. Like, they aren't low in the standings. So I think that it is still a very promising start. And their goal differential is only -3. So, I mean, it's not terrible to start the year either. It could be better, but, I mean, you could say that about any team. Some teams with a slow start. I noticed Washington's having kind of a slower start just after the year that they had last year. Ovechkin only has 2 points, I believe, in the first 12 games, or 2 goals in the first 12 games.
I saw a statistic on Ovechkin this season. He has 0 defensive starts. So meaning the team has put him on the ice 0 times while they've been in the defensive zone.
Wow. That's
I don't even know how that's possible. It's kind of amazing, but yep, he literally has not played defense once. It's on purpose, obviously, because they're trying to reduce how much he has to skate.
Right.
But I guess that says something to how many more years he's got left in the league.
Do you think this is the last year of Alex Ovechkin?
You know, I think it depends a little bit on him. Yeah. I could see a team signing him still for like a year or two, maybe. But
he seems like a kind of guy that would want to be a lifer on Washington, though.
I think he would just stay in Washington indefinitely. I mean, I think it depends on how this season ends. If it's just like a total abysmal season, I think he still wants the 900 goals.
Right, right.
I think that's something for him. But I think 1,000 is totally not happening at this current rate. But I said that before about him breaking Gretzky's record, so you can prove me wrong.
No, that's a really good point, too, because I was going to say, like, but I mean, like, it's just been completely different from, well, he's only 1 goal away from 900, so he should definitely get that soon. But he has 7 points in 12 games to start the season. He has 2 goals. That was the stat that I was remembering. But you just look at the last few seasons he's had, like with the 65 points, 73, 75 points. He isn't really on track for that right now. So it could just be a slow start. But again, Washington's a team that was doing really well last year, and we were all surprised. Maybe this is them kind of coming back down to reality a little bit. But only time will tell with the Capitals. Any other teams that have really been highlighted for you, or you're impressed with how they've started, or anything like that?
You know, I would say Utah has been pretty hot. I kind of knew that going into this season. I mean, I look at their roster and I was like, that's going to be a good team. Like, they had tons of options. They had tons of young players, a lot of like high picks, and all of their players are kind of like entering into their prime. Like, they're not necessarily at top peak value yet, but they're definitely like getting better,
right?
And we've seen that this year, like Dylan Gunther, Logan Cooley been really good, Sergachev on the back end has been really good for them too. He's
Habs legend,
good points. Like, some people were even saying this kind of performance he's putting on, he'd be like a borderline Norris candidate. So So yeah, they're looking pretty decent. Their goaltending's been okay, not exceptional, but I'd say that they're a playoff team.
Oh yeah, the way they've been playing, I mean, yeah, there's nothing else to say that they shouldn't be. But they've got a tough division. Colorado and Winnipeg also look very good in that division. I mean, Winnipeg's already got a 15 goal differential, which is pretty crazy within 12 games. But both of those teams are looking pretty good. A team in the Pacific, I think the Anaheim Ducks are off to a pretty hot start. Now, they really are, I mean, I guess they are still doing pretty well compared to what we thought. I think we thought that they were going to definitely take strides this year and be a little bit better, but I didn't expect them to be better than the Golden Knights and the Oilers this early on in the season.
Yeah, I'm going to put that one up to a bit of a hot streak.
Okay, fair enough.
There's no way. I mean, like, in my mind, like, them playing Vegas in the first round, like, I don't see any scenario they win that. But, yeah, you know, maybe Vegas has tons of injuries or something. I don't know. Maybe, I guess it's theoretically possible. But, I don't know. I think that's one of those teams where, like, they could potentially have a good regular season performance, but I don't see it coming through in the postseason at all, really.
Yeah, no, just a lot of inexperience on that team. And I agree with you that I don't think it's sustainable. They can prove us wrong, though. Calgary's pretty in the down in the dumps this year. Are they? You think they're the favorite for Gavin McKenna at this point?
Oh man, I saw something that I thought was so funny. So Ryan Huska is the head coach of the Calgary Flames. I saw a video of him talking to his team after they got smoked the night prior.
Yeah.
And he had like a. I don't know if it was a screen. I couldn't see what was on the screen. I just saw him presenting it. I think it was a screen, and he put in the result of the game the night prior to ChatGPT or something, and he was like reading out some sort of ChatGPT analysis to the room, and I just thought that was very fitting to their current performance.
Oh man.
Yeah, that was pretty funny to watch, I have to say. I was just like, oh man, it looked like I felt like he was just kind of one of the older people that had just discovered ChatGPT and was like, man, I gotta try this out.
I mean, if maybe they're that desperate, maybe they're that low, they're struggling that bad that they need to get into the Gen Z coaching strategies. I wonder if Sam's a big chat user for when he was coaching his little guys.
No chance.
But yeah, no, that's crazy. I mean, and we were talking about goal differential a little bit earlier, but we look at the opposite end of the spectrum. They're already at a minus 17, but they've only scored 31 goals. And I mean, I don't even think I can really blame Wolf. I mean, he's looked all right in net. I think he's just like, he's just having a tough go of it right now with the amount of offense that team is producing. But Calgary is definitely a team. I don't know if they're getting out of this. I mean, sometimes you can see teams get a slow start. Like, I think St. Louis is having a slow start right now, and I think they're going to turn it around. Same kind of with the Rangers. Although the Rangers' offense seems to be pretty non-existent. They've scored the same amount of goals as Calgary to start the season. So,
yeah.
Really interesting first 12 games of the season, first 12 to 14 games of the season. It will be interesting to see. I mean, this is also, we're coming up to an Olympic year too, right? So we've got some guys that like are kind of extra motivated, I feel like. I think we see some guys that got passed over during the First Nations that are trying to make their way onto the team. I think Nick Suzuki is one of those guys. I mean, just with how he's been playing. I mean, since the Four Nations, like including last year, he's tied with David Pastrnak for the most points in the NHL. With something like 55 points in 37 games. Something ridiculous like that. He's been playing really well. But there are some players that I think are kind of playing themselves off of the Team Canada team, too. I think Robert Thomas is off to a pretty slow start. I mean, that might just be a whole St. Louis thing, because I also think Jordan Binnington has not played like he deserves to be on Team Canada. And, I mean, that's crazy, because he was like the heart and soul of that Four Nations run. What do you think about Canada's goaltending situation? I feel like we talked about this last year before the Four Nations, but I mean, it seems to me the most inconsistent thing in the world.
I'm feeling better about Logan Thompson. You know, he's still chugging along. His numbers are still pretty good, and his team's not doing that well.
Yeah.
So I feel decent about him. I would say one other player I would mention though is that Macklin Celebrini. I've been pretty hot on him. Mm-hmm. But the guy's tied for third, I think, in points in the NHL right now as a rookie, which is just, or as a young player, sorry, which is just ridiculous. I mean, yeah. And on the Sharks too. Like he's been really good. So if he keeps that up, he could potentially be rostered. I could see that.
What do you think about Matthew Schaefer? Do you think he's going to get a chance to be? Because I think I've seen some people say he's a dark horse to get on the team, and I think that'd be incredibly rare for a rookie to get added to the team, especially an 18-year-old rookie to get added to Team Canada. But he's putting up some really decent numbers. He's got about 5 goals and 5 assists. So he's 10 points through the first 13 games for the Islanders. Not too bad, not too shabby. He's definitely, I would say, up there in the Calder race right now. But what do you think about Schaefer getting added to Team Canada? You think that's a lot more unlikely?
I think the problem is Team Canada's just so deep that, you know, 12 games and 10 points, oh my God, like, doesn't really mean much in the grand scheme of things, like, especially compared to, like, people that have, like, proven track records of performance, especially in playoffs. So he's never even played in a playoff series before. It'd be tough.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Drew Doughty, though, I don't know.
That's what I was going, like, to talk about, yeah.
I just don't know, like, I thought he was decent in the First Nations, but I don't know, man. Like, he's injury prone. He's older. I think it's just a little bit of a risk at this point.
Yeah, and he hasn't played very well this year either to start the year. I mean, LA's kind of also doing quite average, if not below average, what we expected them to do. But I was really surprised with how Doughty's been playing. I mean, I really hope that a lot of these guys are just off to slower starts and it's just going to take a little bit to get going. But, I mean, if he keeps playing, if Doughty keeps playing the way he's playing and Schaefer keeps playing the way he plays, I mean, maybe it comes down where you got to make the decision to go with the guy that's got a little bit more production going for him. I mean, we know international hockey is really fast paced and a lot of the younger guys are better suited for international hockey than some of the older guys. But I mean, it might be a possibility. On the other hand, I mean, some guys that are playing really well that were left off and are older, John Tavares is playing quite well for Toronto right now. I think that is partly because of Mitch Marner's absence in Toronto, but he's looking like almost like a different player and like someone that I would have had on the Four Nations last year if he was playing this well.
I've actually always liked him as I thought on the Toronto Maple Leafs, I thought that he was always like the player that kind of showed up in the playoffs, at least from my, you know, when I was watching, not even just in terms of points, like even though he usually would be relatively productive, I thought he was just an all round, like sound player. Like he didn't have that many like mistakes, like, you know, even like someone like Marner had tons of like fatal mistakes in playoff games. I never really was Tavares that was the one that was kind of like at least giving up a big, you know, penalty or anything like that. And I thought he was there when they needed an extra goal or, you know, kind of a playmake. So, I wouldn't mind him on the team, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think he's played well. I mean, he's got 16 points in 13 games and has been one of the backbones for the Leafs to start the season. So, I think that he would definitely earn a spot on that roster. Kind of going off of what we were talking about with Tavares, but was able to see the London Knights came to town in Kingston, and I got to watch them take on Kingston. Got to go with Jack Stubbs and Aiden Peterson. It was a pretty good time. Kingston ended up losing 6-1. London was all over them. Kingston took some bad penalties, and I mean, I think London scored about four or five goals in the second period. And then Kingston added a goal with like 30 seconds left in the game to break up the shutout. But London's got a goalie that I think is next up. Alexei Medvedev looked insane in net for London. He's a Vancouver Canucks prospect. And I was really impressed because even though Kingston was getting outplayed, he was able to stop about 31. I think he had 30 out of 31. So still a great game from the big guy, but he is something else. He's 6'3", 181 pounds, and I mean, he's only 18 years old, too. So these goalies coming up, I mean, I think that we could see some stars coming up. I think we've kind of seen the quality of goaltending go down over the past few years, minus like guys like Hellebuck, Bobrovsky, Vasilevsky, guys that play well in the playoffs. I think that we are kind of coming upon a golden age of goaltenders just with the prospects. Because Kingston's also got a good prospect in Gavin Betts that played for the U-17 Team Canada team this past summer. So I think it's an exciting time coming up, but I mean, I will definitely keep an eye out on some of these Frontenacs prospects, some of the Frontenacs games going forward in the podcast. But Yeah, no, great stuff going on. Kyle, have you been able to check out any 67s games or anything anything going on with the...
I haven't yet. I'm planning to go see a 67s game relatively soon. I think the reason why a lot of good prospects are in the CHL right now is because of the NCAA rule changes. So a lot of young players actually are, like, all the best young players now are just going to play in the CHL because they can still play in the NCAA after. Mm-hmm. So the incentive is there, right? Like, and then also to, it's a kind of like a compounding thing, right? So now all the best players are going to the CHL. So the only way to prove yourself early on is now playing in the CHL. So yeah, the CHL has just gotten infinitely more competitive.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a great thing. I think it's great for both, honestly, for both leagues. I think it's good for college hockey, and I think it's good for the OHL. You kind of, with college hockey, you get to see a little bit how the players will look closer to draft day or like after they've been drafted, right? You get to maybe see them develop a little bit better. But I mean, it was good to see a lot of high skilled players still in the OHL going to that game. I mean, it was fast paced. It was looked like super good hockey. And I think that was something that a lot of people were worried about when the original rule change happened, is that everyone would just kind of dart for college hockey. But I think it's good that they're almost like working together in tandem.